Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
I sometimes think to myself, Martin, that there won't be anything for us to talk about next week. How silly of me to think like that. I just made a few quick mental thoughts about things that have happened. New Prime Minister, he's popular when he didn't seem to be before the election all that popular. He's been off travelling around the region, Japan, Indonesia, Indonesian islands, back home. Penny Wong, the foreign minister, has become the foreign minister. Back as we talk, I think, in the Pacific, trying to counter the Chinese. We've got lots of talk on the Indigenous front, including about trying to integrate Indigenous culture into Australian mainstream thinking, something I think you touched on last time when we were talking about the voice proposals. Then we've had a cold snap in the East, the energy crises. People are starting to talk about recession with stock markets going up and down. In the middle of all of that, the WA government tell us they're going to close down coal-fired power stations. And then, as if to try and get in on the action, the shadow cabinet turns up from Canberra and has a meeting in Perth. Perhaps I could just start with the last one. What was that all about, Martin?
Oh, well, it is smart. Yeah, the Libs copped an absolute hiding over here. And I'm just looking through the details now. I think we're going to end up with probably the largest 10 electorates in terms of two-party preferred swing. In other words, swing from Labor, from Liberal to Labor, all in Western Australia, all of them. So it just reinforces the magnitude of what happened here and how it actually did differ significantly from other parts. So when you see that, the natural and sensible thing for the opposition is to go to Perth, because we're a very parochial bunch. You want to be seen here. And mea culpa, what do we need to do to rebuild the brand, listen to some people, et cetera. And now I'm not saying that's a magic bullet to solve all the problems, but it's the only thing, and it's really the only choice that you have. You need to go and do that work, and they probably need to keep coming here.
So the optics are good, and we'll all watch and wait and see what happens in WA, because they're still probably letting some blood after the state election 18 months ago. But there we go. Let's come back to the beginning of the various matters I mentioned. What are you making so far of Mr. Albanese's, I think we have to call him Elbo by decree, Elbo's performance so far? It's nearly 4 weeks, this Saturday, since the election.
look, he's got obviously got a jump in popularity and boost to his ratings. But that is relatively normal. It worked for Kevin Rudd as well. And I think after you win elections from opposition, I think there's some stuff out in Peter Malinauskas in South Australia, et cetera. You always look good. You've had a glorious victory. You've trounced your opponents. And more importantly, and I know that we're going to touch on this, the problems that exist are the problems of your predecessors initially. So you don't have any of those baggage of government. So he's sort of basking in that aftermath of election victory. Also, probably the other thing that, and I'm just prefacing all of this because I don't think it necessarily lasts. There's a lot of work that needs to be done around issues to make that last. But one thing that helps is when you're on the international stage and you're representing the country, and often that's seen as a breath of fresh air. And that certainly worked in places like Indonesia and in Japan and other places. So it's been a very solid start for Albo, if you can call him that, so far. But there are some icebergs on the horizon that he's struggling to deal with, of course.
Well, one of those icebergs on the horizon might be bicycle riding. I was watching the clip in the Presidential Palace precinct with Joko the other day, and he looked decidedly unsteady. He might need to practice around the lodge.
I think he was a little bit wobbly, wasn't he? I think they looked like they're having a good time.
Well, you know, you have to pick your game. If you don't know how to throw a frisbee, it's probably a good idea not to engage in that either. But one of the things that has happened, and it might fit into that category of the sins of the government that's just gone out, is this amazing energy crisis. that's engulfing the eastern states, all of the Australian jurisdictions except us in the Northern Territory. I've been watching the CEO of the regulator on television, and I'm as confused listening to him as I am to anybody else. But we were able to sort of bask in some glory, having made some sensible decisions here over time. What do you see happening with all of that? Are there implications for the federal politics?
Oh, certainly there are. And we talked last week, one of the things we did talk about is cost of living. And there's a number of really important signature things that the government wants to do and they're keen to track forward on. But there's also all of those immediate issues that affect day-to-day living. And this is firmly in that realm. It does touch on the climate change piece, of course, because there's a really clear connection there. But they need to solve the immediate energy needs. And the problem you've got is these things are actually long-term issues, and then you have a short-term problem that emerges. We need a long-term transition to renewable energy sources that puts in place not only their sources, but puts in place capacity surges and puts in place battery storage and other ancillary measures to make them work. None of that's rocket science. I think everyone's saying that. And then you've got a short-term capacity issue where literally there's not enough energy right now. So whatever policies the federal government have, they're 10-year policies. Some of them are 30 or 40-year policies, and yet they've got to click the finger and solve an energy problem on the doorstep. So you can see why it's very, very tricky. WA, you mentioned Western Australia, and we keep coming back to our own state here. We were very smart. I think we owe Alan Carpenter, I think, some credit here, who reserved 15% of our gas reserves for WA usage. And he says, and I'm sure he's probably right in this score, that he copped a lot of flack from other premiers or federal ministers and this, that, and the other, calling us strange. I think he used the word hillbillies for being parochial and trying to reserve some of that precious source for ourselves. Well, I think that we're coming away with the bigger grin on our faces now. Now, no one's happy to see energy source problems anywhere in Australia, and it's very hard for people on low incomes in particular down the eastern seaboard. But if we had been, I think, more constructive in the past and looked to shore up our own energy sources firmly, then maybe this wouldn't have happened. But greater minds than me are working on this now.
It is interesting, particularly whether the 15% policy approach might be emulated in the long run. One expects, though, that the horse is bolted. But at the same time, just the other day, Premier McGowan, who we occasionally call the Admiral here at the Shipping News, announced that we're phasing out by the end of this decade coal-fired power stations. Now, that is a very interesting decision. Is it one that you expected to happen?
Yes, I did. And I don't think that's an earth-shattering thing. I'm not pretending to have any special insights except to say that we actually have other options, and we've been better placed for some time. So, and I think even people in Collie, which is the sort of heart of coal mining in Western Australia, have been saying since that announcement that they expected this, that they thought it was coming. Naturally, they're very worried about the timing of it, and they're talking about transition and the jobs for people, which are all really important issues, but the broader transition can't be denied. So I think that's always been on the horizon. We do have a very substantial gas supply here, which helps in the short term as a bridging technology. And then, of course, longer term, as we get better at this, we have an abundance of renewable energy sources. A lot of sun shines in Western Australia, lots of wind, lots of waves, a lot of renewable energy technology that keeps getting better. So they're talking about hydropower as well. They're talking about batteries to make sure that the storage capacity is much better. Clearly, you need a very comprehensive replacement of coal-fired power. But if they do this and do this really well, then it's going to make a massive difference environmentally. So it's by far the biggest piece around emissions in Western Australia is energy source generation.
The alternative to fossil fuel sources of energy, of course, is going to be more important as we have to phase away from gas. At the same time, it seems both the state of Western Australia and the federal government are supportive of the Scarborough Pluto project, which on estimates by people like Bill Hare, which we've posted here on the Shipping News, would blow out a national carbon budget. What do you see the politics of the Scarborough Pluto project to be, both nationally and in Western Australia?
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert on the specific issue, as you'll appreciate, but I think that, you know, the broader issue of gas and where people tend to place it, because we're outsiders sort of perusing a broader debate. Gas seems to me to be the in-between piece that helps in the short term, because you want to move away from coal-fired power. It's by far the dirtiest technology. Gas is better, but renewable energies are the zero emissions piece. But the thing about gas, it's a very reliable and dependable source, and it's emitting a lot less carbon than coal. So it's clearly a better response. Now, sometimes you get people that are probably less concerned about climate change that see gas as the answer, almost like it's an end to the game, but it's not. It's designed to be a piece in the mix. And only just from what I read is that you need a mix of different technologies to replace coal, that something like gas is very helpful, shall I say, in the short term in helping make that transition. But where we want to get down the track, technology-wise, is to a situation where renewable energies are providing consistent baseline power and have that capacity to respond to changing needs as they arise.
I mentioned Penny Wong, Foreign Minister, and she certainly put up a case bolding and underlining on the word foreign since she was sworn in nearly 4 weeks ago. And I expect, that we're going to see a lot of her not in Australia?
I think she'll travel a lot and she would be really wise to. I remember Kevin Rudd once getting criticised as foreign minister, this was under Gillard, for travelling too much. And I just think that's crazy. There was probably some other reasons to criticise Kevin Rudd at the time. I don't think he had a particularly healthy relationship with the prime minister, but that's another whole thing. In terms of travelling, that's what we expect a foreign minister to do. It's not easy. It's tough on, your home life and everything else, but it's actually core business. The thing is, when you're a fairly isolated, sometimes remote international player, you have to go to where those other places are. You've got to go to the US, you've got to go to the UK and Europe, but you've also got to go to a range of other places. I think a lot of Asian destinations are going to be really important to us. You've got to build those personal relationships. A lot of diplomacy is about personal relationships. And at the end of the day, your foreign minister is our chief diplomat. That's their job.
So I expect that means, at least in the case of the foreign minister, we can't expect her to be reasonably criticised for having a large carbon footprint.
Well, yeah, it's one thing I sort of see with eco warriors, as they're sometimes called, is they get criticised for flying too much. Well, it's true, and online, has helped in that regard. But when it comes to diplomacy, person-to-person diplomacy is essential. So you don't really have a choice. And here's another one to throw in the mix. Which is more costly and expensive, diplomacy or war? Diplomacy or a complete breakdown in your trade situation? So the alternatives to diplomacy are almost always much, much worse. So I'd much rather pay someone to fly around to different places and put out potential spot fires and help build relationships than it would be to supply lots and lots of arms to a place of conflict or to try and resettle the refugees that come out of that. So that's my piece, Michael. I think diplomacy, if it's effective, can make a massive difference.
Martin, swinging around to I was going to say domestic, but state domestic politics. As I mentioned earlier, we're a fair way into the new McGowan government. They get 4 years. How are they travelling? I might partly preface the question or add to it by saying you probably, like me, receive a range of ministerial statements. They come out every day. It looks like a lot of government schools are about to be repaired at the moment. How do you see the state government performing?
I've been one of those people who always expected those stratospheric popularities of Mark McGowan to come back to normal at some stage. I'm still waiting, I think, in a way. I don't think it's happened yet. Clearly, the federal election, we've only just had it, still demonstrates there's a lot of latent popularity that he's got. You know, he was introducing Anthony Albanese out here. He was clearly the person to go to tear strips off the federal government. So I think that's still there. I never subscribe to that policy that everything goes swimmingly well. There's always challenges. You can't ignore the biggest single elephant in the room, that's health, which is clearly still a problem. Ambulance ramping, capacity, things like that. Obviously, they put a lot of money into that. Sometimes perhaps that money takes time to come through, particularly around infrastructure projects, but perhaps around hospital beds and the like as well. But we're all waiting for things to improve there. So I don't think you can ignore that. We talked about the environmental decision around transitioning away from coal. I think that's a really good one. I think that will help Labor's base in particular, who are always looking for reasons why they are electing a Labor government. That's probably one. I think that they're doing fine at the moment, and I think that that's the one thing. You know, if you want an interesting, there's a little interesting issue coming up, and that's that there's an impending resignation from a member for the Nationals from the bush, Vince Catania, who's been in politics for 17 years. We'll see how confident Labor are about how they're travelling in the bush by whether they can test that election. If they're feeling like they're still in a very strong position, why wouldn't you have a crack at stealing another seat off the opposition and crippling them further? If you're a bit nervous and hesitant about how you might travel, that maybe they won't contest. So watch that space. I think that'll be an interesting one.
Well, he was once a member of the Labor Party, Vince Catania, and he left, became an independent, and I notice the media recording that he didn't get a very warm farewell from the Legislative Council Labor people when he left.
There's still some very bad blood. I think their chief beef is after the 2008 election, when the parliament was very much still in the balance. There was a Liberal government, Liberal National sort of government. His decision to abandon the Labor Party, and a lot of people had put a lot of work into electing him to join the Nationals, left a very sad taste very bad taste in their mouths. And there's clearly some people who still haven't forgiven him for that time. But, you know, 17 years in public life is a pretty broad contribution, I guess, just to acknowledge that.
Why wouldn't Labor run a candidate?
It's a good question. The only reason why you wouldn't run a candidate is if you're somewhat embarrassed because you go a fair way backwards. That's the one reason. There's a resources reason, of course. You know, you've got to throw a lot of resources at it. I don't think the Labor Party in Western Australia is stuck for resources at the moment. So I they've probably got a ready-made candidate in terms of the candidate who ran last time. She was reportedly keen to run again. So all of that's true, but I think if you're worried about having A, no chance of winning it, and B, going backwards, maybe you don't run. I tend to think that it's more benefit than risk, in that, you know, you have a crack, it's a coalition-held seat, so if you lose a coalition-held seat, so what? You know, you haven't got that much to lose. By-elections often don't work well for government, so that's a ready-made excuse if you lose. I would think that there's pressure on the Nationals if you run, because if they were to lose another seat, that would be rather really disappointing for them. They don't have a lot of members. and the opposition loses another one. So I tend to think there's probably more benefits than risks, but we'll see.
Well, Martin, we're getting towards the end of our chat today. Are there any quietly smouldering issues at the state or federal level that you are predicting at the moment?
Well, I think you've covered off on those pretty well, and the range of issues that are around. Look, we're getting for election aficionados, we're getting all of the dribs and drabs, particularly Senate results coming in. We've got Tasmania results.
What's the latest on the Senate?
Well, the wizened Erica Betts, of liberal folklore, social conservative and whatnot, has lost his seat in Tasmania today, and Jackie Lambie's team has picked up a second one. So if you think you've seen enough of Jackie Lambie, well, hold fire, because there's two of them. Now it looks like the second one's pretty outspoken like the first, so watch that. Probably the one other one I'd just throw around is David Pocock, ex-rugby player elected to the ACT Senate formally. So a couple of interesting bits and pieces trickling out from the Senate result coming through.
Martin, as always, it's been lovely chatting with you. Thank you very much for your view from the Roundhouse.
My pleasure.